Hello and welcome to the podcast of moralapologetics.com. Our aim is to get you thinking about the moral arguments for God's existence. We think these arguments have the unique ability to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. We're glad you're here, and we hope you enjoy the conversation. This week on the podcast, we have the very special privilege of talking with Dr. Gary Yates. Before coming to Liberty, Gary pastored churches in Kansas and Virginia and taught at Cedarville University in Ohio. Gary and his wife, Marilyn, have been married for over 25 years and have 3 children, one of them a student at LU. Dr. Yates' special interests are in the Old Testament, the prophets, biblical theology, and Hebrew language. He also is involved in preaching and teaching in a local church. So one thing I want to point out about Dr. Yates' bio there is that he was a pastor for a number of years. And I think that that is going to come out actually in the tone and the approach that he takes with this week's podcast. Dr. Yates is not just about solving intellectual problems, but he has a real pastoral concern for people who have doubts about the goodness of God that are raised by these problem passages in the Old Testament. A conversation took place about a week ago in the PhD conference room over at the seminary. It was a beautiful day. We had the windows open. So you actually hear a little bit of construction going on occasionally. But with that, let's get right to Dr. Yates and the discussion on the character of God in the Old Testament and the problem of the Canaanite conquest. All right, so we're going to start here with a quote from Richard Dawkins about the character of God in the Old Testament. And it's pretty intense, but here it is. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. Misogynistic, homophobic, racist. Infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal. Pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously benevolent bully. Okay, well, that's quite an accusation there.
Yeah. Wow.
And I put it to you, the Old Testament scholar, is that an accurate representation of what the Old Testament says about the character of God?
Well, he's used some very creative adjectives there, yeah. But I find it hard to believe that anyone can give a fair or honest reading to the Old Testament and come to that conclusion about the God of the Old Testament. And in some ways, I think we may not be surprised that an atheist like Dawkins would come to that conclusion. What concerns me and troubles me a bit as both a pastor and an Old Testament professor is that I often see evangelicals or those that are somehow connected to Christianity or to evangelical Christianity sort of giving credence to that idea or to the idea that the God of the Old Testament is fundamentally different from the God of the New Testament.
Right.
We almost seem to be back to where we were with Marcion, who wanted to get rid of the Old Testament God in favor of the New Testament one. And I think the starting point in all of these discussions, part of this has to do with ethical difficulties that people have with various parts of the Old Testament. It may be the stories of the wars of the Old Testament, particularly the holy wars in the book of Joshua, or it may be difficult passages where we see God breaking out in anger, like with Uzzah when he touches the ark and is struck dead, or some of the laws of the Old Testament that seem to not reflect our ideals about how women or slaves or those kinds of things should be treated. But I think we have to step back from that, and instead of focusing first on those issues or maybe looking at certain difficult problem passages, is to get a good general understanding of just the nature of God in the Old Testament. And I think one of the key passages, and I'd like to read it, and for those that are listening, try placing this beside what you just read Richard Dawkins saying about the God of the Old Testament. Here's what Moses said, and it's actually what God reveals to Moses about his character. And he says, "The Lord passed before Moses and proclaimed, 'The Lord, a God, merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation.'" And so as God is describing his character, and remember that this is in the book of Exodus after God has initially revealed himself to Moses as Yahweh, I am. And in many ways, the blank of I am what? What does that look like? And what kind of God is this Yahweh? This is the defining statement of what that God should be like. It's also the statement that God makes about himself after Israel has worshipped the golden calf. They have fundamentally broken the covenant with God at the very beginning of this relationship, while Moses is still up on the mountain getting the details of the covenant. If it's like a marriage, they've cheated with God on the honeymoon. And yet God extends grace and mercy and compassion to his people. In response to the prayers of Moses, he does not destroy them. And even though he disciplines them and punishes them for this egregious violation of the covenant, he does forgive them and restore them, and he reflects this idea, I'm gracious, I'm merciful, I'm slow to anger. The idea of mercy, the Hebrew word there, is related to the Hebrew word for the womb. And so it's almost like a motherly type of compassion. The expression where God says that he's slow to anger, literally in the Hebrew says he's long of nose. And so, in other words, his nostrils don't flare or he doesn't explode in anger quickly. And so there are times where God does respond in wrath and where God strikes people dead or commands things that seem ethically difficult for us. But this is the underlying nature of God throughout the Old Testament. And this aspect of God, I think, rings out far more clearly in the Old Testament than the problem passages that a person like Dawkins or even certain people who call themselves Christians who say we have to redeem the Bible and redeem ourselves from the ethic of the Old Testament. This is the character of God. And one of the things that's interesting about this passage is that this confession about God actually becomes a statement that is repeated, I think, something like 10, 12, 14, 15 times in the Old Testament. It's a recurring thing in the Psalms. Psalm 103, as far as our sins are from the east, he removes our sins as far as the east is from the west. Well, why does he do that? Because he's an Exodus 34, 6, and 7 kind of God. In the Minor Prophets, which are 12 prophetic books that have been stitched together as one book, there are a number of those books that are going to repeat this particular formula and talk about the fact that God is merciful, gracious, slow to anger. He relents from his anger. So I think we need to start with what's the fundamental nature of God in the Old Testament and then get to the problem passages and the problem issues. The other thing that's, I think, very important to understand in this passage, notice the contrast that's here. In verse 7, he keeps love for thousands of generations, okay? Mm-hmm. He visits punishment for 3 to 4 generations. God is far more inclined to show mercy than he is to show wrath. And it's a more fundamental aspect of God's character to show mercy, grace, compassion. Wrath is something that has to come because of something from the outside that has prompted God to respond in that way to people. And so there's quite a difference between genocidal, filicidal, yeah, megalomaniacal, yeah, and Exodus 34, 6, and 7.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And I think maybe with the wrath, and so God is wrathful sometimes, but it seems like maybe you could even talk about the wrath of God as a means for him to be able to love. I mean, the idea comes to mind of when C.S. Lewis talks about we don't want so much as a father in heaven as a grandfather in heaven. Mm-hmm. We want, in other words, the idea is that we just kind of want, we want things to go easy and us just kind of have a soft, comfortable life. What we really want as a God would just give us what we want instead of what we really need. And a lot of times, I mean, wrath is really discipline, right? Is that right for the Old Testament?
Yeah, I think that's true. And especially we see this in God's relationship with Israel. The wrath that he shows is never simply striking out in anger. It's always to purge the people away from following a path that's ultimately destructive for them. God responds in anger when the people of Israel worship idols, mm-hmm. not because he's a jealous high school teenager,
right.
but because he knows the destructive effect that chasing after these other guys will have. And so the wrath at times is the discipline is quite severe, but ultimately the goal of that is that he'll purge and cleanse the hearts of the people so they'll want to follow him.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's right, but I also think that our skeptical friends are going to have an objection here.
Yeah.
They're going to say that, at least one objection, maybe you could think of another one, but what comes to mind is they're going to say, well, look, this situation is like, you know, an abusive husband who says that he's going to punish his wife for her own good. You know what I mean? So the, hitting her in the face, he says, this is for your own good. This, you didn't make the pancakes the way I liked. So, you know, I mean, obviously that's very, it hurts just to kind of make that comparison to God. But right. That's what people are going to say is that, well, you know, you can't have love and then, it was in Exodus or Numbers, I think, where God swallows people up from in the ground, right? Right? So how do we make sense of that? Is that analogy between husband and wife, abusive husband and wife, hold in the Old Testament, or how do you respond to that?
Okay. Yeah, there's a... First of all, in general, the relationship that God has with Israel is depicted as the relationship between a husband and a wife throughout the Old Testament. And the question, the issue that you raise there makes me think of certain prophetic passages where, the idea is that God is going to discipline his wife by physically punishing her.
Right.
And sometimes even the imagery is that Israel is like a woman who is going to be stripped naked. She's going to be exposed, and that's going to be part of her punishment. I think part of that, yeah, and these are troubling passages. There's a description of the judgment of Nineveh, the city of Nineveh, where she is depicted as a woman that is basically beaten, exposed. And some theologians have even used the terminology that in the prophets we have what's called porno prophetic language, or God has been referred to as the divine rapist. I think there are a couple of things that we do have to keep in mind. One is the fact that we are dealing with an ancient Near Eastern text. Mm-hmm. We are dealing with a text that meets that culture where it was. And marriage was a very different relationship at that time. Marriage was an unequal relationship, and often, you know, physical punishment was involved. Adultery itself, the crime of adultery, was punishable by a capital offense. And so that imagery is certainly used there, and it's part of how God communicates to that culture. But again, I think more in the sense of not exonerating or commending that kind of behavior, as just warning the people, these are the consequences, the things that are going to happen to you if you do turn away from the Lord. And so I think an example of that, one of the things that's going to happen to Israel and Judah when God punishes them is that the Assyrians, the Babylonians are going to come in. What happens in the context of ancient Near Eastern warfare? Women, children, they're the ones that are going to be abused. The women are going to be raped. They're going to experience the horrible consequences of this. So I think in part what God's doing with this, again, is not condoning spousal abuse,
right,
as much as saying, here are the consequences that are going to come about. And if I can help you to see that in advance,
yeah,
then maybe you'll steer away from those things.
So I think part of the response or two is to really emphasize that it is, this is not literally, not literal language. It's metaphorical language. But I wonder if maybe you can comment too.
Yeah, and if I could just elaborate on that a little bit more. God is portrayed throughout the Old Testament as the one who defends widows and orphans.
Right.
So you think of the most hopeless, the most helpless women in the society of the ancient years. God is a father for those. God cares for widows and orphans. There are ways in the Old Testament law that we could look at that that put limitations on that again meet the culture where it's at. And may not be the final statement on morality and ethics, and we certainly realize that. And the Old Testament is very much conditioned by its ancient Near Eastern environment. But the Lord is meeting that society where it's at, trying to lift it to a new level.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask you about is, and I've heard this, and maybe you can tell me if this is true or not, but that considering in the culture at the time, the ethics of the Torah, for example, are very progressive. And gives giving women a much higher status than they would have had outside of the culture. So is that right?
Yeah, I think that's true. It's certainly not, you know, we're not at the place where marriage itself is even viewed as an egalitarian relationship.
Right.
And we're not even at the point of the Christian ethic of the New Testament. But from the very beginning, Genesis 1 is going to stress God created male and female as the image of God, as God's images.
Right.
And so that royal authority and that royal position that's given to humans is not something that's exclusively for the male. It's for the woman, and for the female as well as the male.
How unique would that be? I don't know if you know this or not, but it's when I read Genesis 1 in particular about the creation of man and woman, it strikes me as being incredibly egalitarian. God made both man and woman in his image. They're both sharing that equally. And that seems to me to be something that you would not expect to find among a lot of other ancient Near East cultures.
Well, just the idea of humanity in general as the image of God. Egyptian culture, for example, they would have viewed the king as God's image. And Richard Middleton and some other people, I think, have made a very valid point that Genesis is a polemic against that, so that, you know, the most abject servant and slave bears the image of God as much as the king does. And there's a royal dignity to all human life. And so we haven't touched on the whole topic of slavery yet.
Right,
but again, that's another where God's meeting the culture where it's at. But God's ideal is that all of humanity possesses royalty. And that's true of both the man and the woman. And so I think that is incredibly enlightened for the time and the culture of the ancient Near East that we're dealing with.
Yeah, so let's go back to this. So we started with the character of God. Mm-hmm. And we saw that the most fundamental picture of God's character in the Old Testament is that he's loving, that he forgives, that he's long-suffering. And we also see, for example, that his end is to dwell with man on the earth. Mm-hmm. This is mentioned in Minor Prophets, for example. Mm-hmm. That's to restore what Eden was, right?
Right.
And so we have this picture of God really being concerned and gracious and loving towards human beings. We have already kind of hinted at some of the objections that people might have to that. But let's press into some more objections now. So probably the number one objection that comes up these days is to the Canaanite conquest.
Right.
And often it gets cast in terms of genocide, that the God of the Old Testament supposedly approves and encourages genocide. And that's something that is morally repugnant, and therefore, if it's true that that's who the Old Testament God is like, then he couldn't possibly be real.
Yeah, I want no part of him.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So what do we do with these conquest narratives? What are they saying about God?
Okay.
How do we deal with those?
There's a long discussion here. I think let's begin just by, I'm not sure that the term genocide in some ways is anachronistic to begin with. And I think the term genocide for what goes on in the book of Joshua is inaccurate to begin with, because the purpose of God telling the Israelites to remove the Canaanites, to exterminate them, has nothing to do with ethnic differences or race or a particular prejudice against the Canaanite people. Mm-hmm. It is primarily a spiritual issue where God is asking and God is commanding the Israelites to remove the Canaanites for reasons dealing with more their religious practices and the potential of the Canaanites to be a corrupting influence on the Israelites as they moved into the Promised Land. So I think we got to begin by saying genocide is I think a mislabeling and a mischaracterization of that. And I know Dawkins has compared the Israelites going into Canaan to Hitler's invasion of Poland. Just it's a very poor historical analogy, and it's the wrong starting point for this entire discussion. I think that's important just to elaborate that at the beginning. I think one of the other key points that I want to that I try to make was as I'm teaching through the book of Joshua, war is a pervasive part of the Old Testament. You know, I think all but two books, I think Song of Solomon is one of them. You know, all but two books have something to do with war. But this idea of God commanding the Israelites to wipe out the Canaanites, I want to stress the exceptionality of what's involved there, okay? And exceptional in a number of ways. First of all, the exceptional role that God gave to Israel, where Israel was God's national people, and as a political national entity, they represented God's people on earth. The Davidic king later on is going to be God's human vice regent. And so God executes his kingship through the Davidic king. In the book of Joshua, God is executing his theocratic rule through the people of Israel. That is not true of any nation today. It has not been true since the time of the Old Testament and the termination of the Mosaic covenant with Christ. It will never be true of any nation in the future. You cannot look at this passage and provide any type of responsible theological defense for an idea that that this rationalizes or endorses any kind of violence like this by any group of people at any point of history. And so I think that exceptionality, it's also exceptional in the sense that the type of conquest and the type of warfare that Israel is commanded to carry out, where, you know, to put the Canaanites under the ban, the harem, as it's referred to, that is not even in the Old Testament the typical way that Israel engages in battle, where God tells them, you know, go in, you're to wipe out everyone, the women, the children, the combatants, the non-combatants, the animals, if it breathes, kill it. That's not the way that Israel normally, carries out warfare. Deuteronomy chapter 20 talks about the differences when Israel would engage in warfare with people outside the land. And there they were to offer terms of surrender. They were to only engage those that were actual combatants. And so the Canaanite situation in Joshua, and one example in the ministry or during the reign of Saul, are the only times where we see Israel specifically practicing this type of harem warfare, where they're basically to wipe out everyone. So I think that's a helpful clarification as well.
Let me ask you about that, because I've heard from some scholars like Matt Flanagan and so forth that this is hyperbolic language, for example. I think he mentions that in one time, in Judges, it says something like, when we wipe them out, men, women, and children, we have like the city, I don't know what city it was, but say Jericho. We have everyone, man, woman, and child from Jericho. And then the next passage says, the people of Jericho attacked us. And then it was suggesting that this was just idiomatic language that was used to. And the other thing, too, is this other point that's often raised is that that the Canaanites could have, it was God made a provision for them to escape, that if they left the city before they attacked,
right,
that they would not be subject to destruction by Israel. So maybe you can just comment on those two things.
Yeah, there's a couple of issues there. I think that there is the idea in certain passages where the Israelites are told to actually drive out the Canaanites rather than to exterminate them.
Okay.
So, yeah, it doesn't seem like totally kill and wipe out all of the Canaanites is a possibility. You also have to realize that in Genesis, God tells Abraham it's going to be 400 years before your descendants inherit the land, because the sins of the Amorites are not yet full. And so the Lord patiently, you know, if we're going to see God as this kind of filicidal, genocidal kind of God that Dawkins is describing, the Lord patiently waits for the Canaanites. And I think they are, I heard one Christian writer writing on this and saying, well, God gave them no voice or no warning of what's about to happen. And that's really not true. Abraham was a significant figure in the land of Canaan when he's there. Mm-hmm. Then when the Israelites go down to Egypt and when God carries out the Exodus, Rahab says that, you know, the people living in the land have heard about this. They have the chance to vacate. They have the chance to get away. And then there are places where the Lord tells the Israelites that they're to drive the Canaanites out. And it seems to provide kind of a counterbalance to these ideas where you're supposed to just go in and completely wipe out and destroy the people. So, yeah, I think there are some opportunities where the Canaanites could have responded the way that Rahab did. And when Rahab responds with, you know, fear, reverence, belief, and worship toward the Lord, she's spared.
Often in the Old Testament, it seems like God will make pronouncements of judgment. And there's this conditional, maybe an unstated conditional, that if you repent,
right,
you can avoid the consequences.
Yeah, we have the, you know, the Ninevites, 40 days and Nineveh will be destroyed. Right. There's no condition attached to that, but yet when the people repent and turn back to God, God doesn't destroy the city. I think the same thing could have happened to the Canaanites. And they have the witness of their conscience. They have the witness of creation, a testifying to the true God. They have the influence of Abraham. And in the events leading up to the 40 years before the conquest, they have the stories of the Exodus. They have heard, there have been reports of what God has done through the Israelites. So there's the opportunity for them to respond to that. Joshua chapter 8 also seems to imply that when the Lord makes covenant with the people at Shechem, that there are foreigners that are there with them. So some of that would have included the descendants of the Egyptians that came out as the mixed multitude during the Exodus, but some of that also likely included Canaanites like Rahab, who either surrendered or expressed their desire to join the Israelite people. That option and that opportunity does seem to have been there. And it was the hardness of their own heart that ultimately led to the fact that they did not take advantage of the opportunities that God gave them.
Well, let's talk too briefly just about.
And I don't want to overstress that point, because I'm not sure that was something that was true for all the people, but that does seem to at least be one of the factors that we have to consider in all this.
That there is at least the potential that if they had repented, they wouldn't have been destroyed.
Right.
But so let's. One other point I think that's relevant here is people might say, well, what could they have been doing that was so bad that they deserve to be totally wiped out, right? Maybe you can comment on that.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, and then we'll get back to this issue about the hyperbolic language and all that.
Yeah.
I think maybe addressing this first is, yeah, I've heard some I think bad apologetics with this, is that, you know, the Canaanites were the most horrible, awful, worst people that ever lived. And you know, I don't think that's accurate.
Okay.
And I read an article or a chapter that Richard Hess had recently written about the Canaanites, looking at some of their, you know, extra-biblical legal documents, And there are people that are concerned about issues of justice and marriage and proper transactions in business. And we'd look at those legal documents and say, what's so creepy about the Canaanites? Mm-hmm. So I think that point can be overemphasized. God does not command the Israelites to destroy the Canaanites because they are the worst people that have ever lived. Or even necessarily that they are more wicked than the other peoples that are around Israel. And in some ways, you know, they may not even be as wicked as the Israelites themselves. That issue is something that I think ultimately comes down to God's sovereignty, that God determines for every nation when the time of reckoning and judgment and accounting comes. That doesn't mean that a nation that is judged in 1400 B.C., is necessarily more evil than the nation that's judged in 1200 B.C. It's not a chronological thing. Every nation has its own cup of wrath. And when that cup of wrath is filled, God is the sovereign judge who has the right to make that decision.
Yeah, and in this context, too, we also have God is using this to make a way for the Messiah and the redemption of the world.
Yeah, and here I think is more the point. The Canaanites did have a very corrupt religious system.
Right.
And the Lord does not want the Israelites to be influenced by that kind of idolatry. And we could mention several things. You know, the god El, if you read some of the Canaanite text about him, is a god that does everything evil that humans can do on a larger scale. He seduces women. He gets drunk. I think in some texts he's depicted even as killing his own family members. So, I mean, these gods are evil and wicked, and when the Canaanites worship these kind of gods, that's ultimately the kind of people that you become. God doesn't want Israel to become that. There were sexual fertility rites and things that basically brought sexual immorality into the context of worship. And we could look at the Canaanite goddesses like the Asherahs and Anat, this god of warfare who's a consort of Baal. The primary reason for God commanding the Israelites to destroy the Canaanites and to remove them has to do with, I think, the religious influence that kind of worship system would ultimately have and the evil that would bring into Israel. The Canaanites, you know, practiced child sacrifice. That's something that's abhorrent to God. And God is very emphatic that he does not want the Israelites to do those kinds of things or practice those kinds of things. And so if we're going to look at, you know, the evil of, first of all, the Canaanites are not evil, are not innocent.
Right.
They are sinners deserving of God's judgment like all of us are. That's true in one sense. But I think also this perverse religious system that they practiced and the close context in which they would live with Israel, that's the primary rationale for this. Again, not that the Canaanites were the most awful, wicked, terrible people on the face of the earth, but where they were in relationship to Israel and the influence that they would have on the people of Israel. And when we ultimately look at the fact that Israel is going to be the conduit of salvation for all nations for all time, preserving the purity of Israel's religion ultimately may have an effect on saving far more lives and saving far more children than would have happened if the Israelites had simply amalgamated and assimilated and become like the Canaanites. And we already know that happened enough in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And we could look at all kinds of examples of like that. Let me make just one more point about the ethics of all of this.
Yeah.
Israel is drawn into Canaanite worship practices, to Baal worship. It's a temptation. I think the first time that we see them worshiping Baal is in Numbers chapter 25, and it's going to be there throughout their history. I think we get a good reflection of the ethical impact that all of this would have had on Israel when we look at the reign of Ahab and Jezebel. And remember the story of Naboth and the vineyard? The ethic of the Old Testament law is that everyone had their land inheritance that came from the Lord. And a God who delivered slaves out of Egypt is going to have that kind of ethic and is going to promote that kind of ethic. On the other hand, Baal, is a god who asserts his power by war, by violence, by those kinds of things. Look at the ethic that that Baal worship promotes when Jezebel says, "Well, if Naboth's not going to give you that vineyard, just go ahead and take it." And that's an ethic that is informed by the worship of the Canaanite gods. The ethic that said, this is Naboth's land. This is his inheritance from the Lord. We're not to touch it. That's the ethic that comes from worshiping a god that delivered slaves out of Egypt. And so I think the pervasive influence that Canaanite worship and religion and ethics and child sacrifice and those things does play a role in why God ultimately makes these commandments. And beyond that, you know, the fulfillment of his covenant promises that God had given to Israel about the land, that ties into the exceptionality of this as well. But it's interesting that later on in Israel's history, even the Old Testament recognizes the exceptionality of what was going on in the book of Joshua. We have a reference in 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 20 and 21, the time of Solomon. And there are still Canaanites around. At that point, they are being enslaved and brought into slave labor. But the time of where they were to be genocided or wiped out or completely exterminated has passed even then. And one of the passages that I wanted to bring in this, I teach the book of Jeremiah. My interest is in the Old Testament prophets. There's an amazing passage in Jeremiah chapter 12, verses 14 to 17. And I wonder if we maybe can just look at this for a second. Jeremiah 12, verses 14 to 17. Jeremiah promises that God is going to judge his people, and the way the terminology he uses is that he's going to tear them down, and then he's going to build them up. He's going to uproot them, and then he's going to replant them in the land. That's what God is going to do for Israel. But the amazing thing that Jeremiah says is that Jeremiah announces that God is also going to do that for any foreign nation that would turn to the Lord. And look at what it says in verse 14. "Thus says the Lord concerning all my evil neighbors who touch the inheritance that I have given my people Israel to inherit. Behold, I will pluck them up from their land, and I will pluck up the house of Judah from among them." So God's going to judge these nations the same way that he judges Judah. But look at verse 15. "And after I have plucked them up, I will again have compassion on them. And I will bring them again, each to his heritage and each to his land." Okay, so God's going to restore these other nations to their heritage and their land. And then it gets even better in verse 16. "And it shall come to pass, if they will diligently learn the ways of my people to swear by my name, as the Lord lives, even as they taught my people to swear by Baal or by Baal, then they shall be built up in the midst of my people." So who are we talking about here that the Lord's going to restore? It's the people that have led Israel into the worship of Baal or Baal. And that would be the Canaanites. And so here you have God promising that in the midst of this future restoration, I'm going to rebuild and replant Israel in their land, but I'm also going to restore these other nations and these other people. Well, who does that include? One of the people it includes are the people that originally led the Israelites astray. So God in his plan of redemption actually ultimately even includes the Canaanites in that. And I think that's why at the very beginning of this discussion, talking about this as genocide is really a misreading of the situation, and I think it's a misreading of the purpose of what God is doing when he tells the Israelites either to drive them out or to destroy them.
Okay, that is really good bookends to think about there, what God's overall intentions. Now, you were going to come back to the hyperbole.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the hyperbole. And this kind of hyperbole is in the book of Joshua, for sure.
And what is we're talking specifically about language of total destruction,
right,
being hyperbolic.
Yeah.
Okay.
The idea that when a text says that, first of all, we killed everybody, we left no survivors. The problem in Joshua is that you turn around, it's like in a few verses after that, there's Canaanites left in the land and there are survivors.
Right, yeah.
One of the things that I've studied that helped me with this, Lawson Younger has written an excellent book on ancient conquest accounts. And this is fairly common, that in ancient conquest accounts, to emphasize the greatness of the victory, there are all kinds of hyperbole that's used. And sometimes it's, we completely wiped out the enemy. They'll often talk about the fact that we defeated them in a single day, mm-hmm. even though it might have involved them marching 75 miles, and we know that it couldn't have happened in a single day. We completely wiped out all of our enemies and totally destroyed them. It was simply a way of saying that we won a significant victory, but it wasn't necessarily a literal reality.
Is it something like if you say a football team?
Yeah,
we slaughtered them.
Yeah, I think it's kind of that idea. Or I tell my kids, or my wife will say, you never pick up your socks, and it's like, that's hyperbole. I did pick them up once.
Or if you tell your kids to clean a room, and you say, I want every speck of dust
right.
off your dresser, or something.
Right.
Like that.
And I don't think this does away with the you know, the abhorrent things that we do read here. I morally struggle with this stuff. I don't want to create the impression that we don't, but I do think that those texts have to be read in light of that. That sometimes that we wiped out every person that was ancient Near Eastern battle reports often do this. Okay, and there's another aspect of this hyperbole element that I think needs to be brought into this. That when you go back to a passage like Deuteronomy chapter 7 and the first verses of that chapter, that some of this rhetoric of completely wipe out and destroy, I believe that there were actual battle accounts. I believe Joshua is telling us how God gave the land to the people of Israel. And a lot of critical scholars would say, this is all basically a fiction anyway.
Right.
And there's kind of an irony where critical scholars will say, well, this didn't happen, but it's really bad. And really, then we're just sort of looking at bad rhetoric. Mm-hmm. But I think there was a real conquest, and there were real battles, and there were real atrocities that happened. And I don't want to deny that, or I don't want to do bad apologetics by, suggesting that that's the case, or that, it really wasn't bad for these people that got it was. But part of the rhetoric, I think, in Deuteronomy where,
Let me pause right there before we go. And I think there needs to be a distinction made. And that is, when we say bad, you're not saying that it was morally
Yeah,
evil.
I'm just saying it was horrific.
Yeah, it was a very painful experience.
Right.
Okay.
Right, yeah. And pardon my imprecise language
there. Oh, no, that's great.
But I think in Deuteronomy 7, that this idea of wipe them out, completely destroy them, that part of the polemic there is more about idolatry than military extermination. And I think sometimes even in Joshua is a historical account, but it's also a rhetorical and a polemicized rhetorical account of what actually happened. And I think some of this emphatic wipe them out, completely destroy them kind of language is more for the benefit for later generations to say God takes this issue of idolatry very seriously. And the proof of that is, again, like in this 1 Kings 9 passage, they realize God's not commanding us to wipe out and destroy these people. We didn't finish the job. Let's go do it. The emphasis is to stress the need for separation from idolatry. So I wonder if some of the rhetoric in there is not just, it's battle rhetoric, but I think some of it is more anti-idol polemic rather than, a detailed strategy of this is exactly the way all this is going to be carried out. Some of the other mitigating factors, some of the cities that were destroyed, like Jericho, I think Richard Hess and Paul Copan have talked about the fact that these may be actually military fortresses. And that the destruction that was carried out there was for specific purposes. We do know that there were only three cities that the book of Joshua talks about that were completely burned and destroyed and wiped out, and that's Jericho, Ai, and Bethel. Jericho, Ai, and Hazor. And so that was kind of, even that was kind of exceptional. They weren't supposed to burn the cities and do all those kinds of things because they were going to end up, you know, moving back into those. So I think there, Joshua is a historical account. Mm-hmm. And again, going back to Younger, he shows how the book of Joshua conforms in many ways to other ancient Near Eastern battle accounts that are real and historical. But I think some of this, in the way that it's described, there's rhetoric involved in this that is stressing for later generations. There needs to be a complete dissociation with the Canaanites. And Douglas Earle, who's written extensively on this, and I don't think I would go to the as far as he has, but he views all of this as being basically metaphorical. And, you know, one thing that maybe we need to just throw into the mix, and again, I don't agree with this, but the early church basically spiritualized or allegorized all of the book of Joshua. That was their approach. But they didn't look at it and say, hey, this provides a rationale for us to go out and genocide. The Israelites themselves and later generations didn't look at this and say, hey, here's our rationale to go out and exterminate our neighbors. They understood the exceptionality of this. And I think I understand kind of the wild rhetoric of someone like, you know, a Dawkins,
right,
who basically is going to give the Bible no benefit of the doubt at all. I'm troubled by people who call themselves Christians, though, and basically don't want to struggle through some of these things that we're talking about and immediately jump to some of the same conclusions.
So some skeptics might say, well, look, you're kind of missing the heart of what I'm saying, because the real objection is not the number of people killed or the,
right,
or the reason, but just that God would command someone to kill other people, and you're saying that's morally okay.
Yeah. And I think the fact that it, again, it's the fact that it did happen, we should pause at these passages, and they give us some serious need for moral and ethical reflection. And I don't want to explain away the horrors of this, and I'm not trying to do that. But I know that one approach that's taken today, and this is again, and you see this in some Christian circles where we want to redeem the Old Testament. There's some value here, but
right,
we've got to. They would argue that well, God didn't actually command them to do this. This is simply Israel's, you know, they're wrestling with God. God and they see God as this kind of tribal deity that's like all of the other gods around them, and so this is just Israel's sort of explanation of this. It is very difficult and very hard for those of us who believe that the story of Joshua is faithful and true. We have a far greater difficulty explaining how could a God command people to do this. And I just a couple of thoughts about that.
Okay, yeah.
One, I think God does have the right to judge. If God is the giver of life, God ultimately has the right to judge. He's the ultimate moral authority in the world. And as the creator, he has the right to do that. It is unique that God would use a nation or an army to do this kind of thing. And I think I would have to say that even though I think the Israelites were, in a sense, executing judgment and justice here, this is not a perfect justice. This is not final justice. And I recognize that. Anytime that you have this kind of, you have the slaughter of innocent people, you have the slaughter of children, that did happen. This is not perfect justice in any sense. But it's also not just the idea that these people had a perception that God had told them to kill somebody. I mean, you know, the people who flew the airplanes in the building, they had a perception that God had told them to do that. There are, again, other things that add to the exceptionality of this. First of all, they not only receive actual directives from God that they're to do this, in many ways, God is the one who primarily carries out these destructions. That, you know, in Jericho, for example, God's the one who causes the earthquake, that causes the walls to tumble,
right,
that brings about the destruction of the city.
Which and you know, the people had a memory of the Exodus as well. I mean, and I think part of the what people are going to object or they're going to, what's going to come into this context is, you know, the mom who thought she heard God say to drive her kids into the lake, you know.
Right.
But what we're putting out is, well, part of the exceptionality of the conquest is there was, God was actually involved.
Yeah, right? there were accompanying events that attested. God drowned the army in the Red Sea.
Right.
God led Israel across across the Jordan by doing the same miracle again. God brought down the walls of Jericho. God rained down the hailstones when Barak and Deborah are fighting. Right. So there are things that supernaturally confirm that.
It wasn't just God, you know, supposedly whispering in somebody's ear.
Exactly.
Right.
And the other thing is that, you know, there are exceptional circumstances. There are specific things that happen where God confirms that this is what he has directed, and God is the one who in many ways brings this about, or God announces through Joshua or through Moses that this is a specific moment in salvation history. This is not a repeatable event. And so I wouldn't want any of this discussion to ultimately come back to say, well, this is providing any kind of rationale for this type of violence today, or for the church to take the book of Joshua and use this as a rationale for going out and destroying our enemies or engaging in what we thought were holy war. Even when holy war was carried out and executed in the Old Testament, there were accompanying things with this that clearly demonstrated God's involvement in this. So it's not just hearing a little inner voice that tells me, go out and do this. Yeah, I think to maybe just to wrap up this whole idea of exceptionality and how this is a unique one-time event, a scholar by the name of Daniel Heinbach in the book Holy War in the Bible that Heath Thomas, Jeremy Evans, and Paul Copan edited, he has these three things that had to be true for an actual holy war to have taken place. The prerequisites are, he says, number one, that a proof crusade always had to be initiated by God and never by anyone else. Number two, that a proof crusade always had to be led by God and never by anyone else. And number three, that a proof crusade always had to be initiated and led by God in a manner that could be verified by those that are called to participate. And so God whispering in the ear of someone, or someone thinking that it's their mission in life to fly an airplane in the building for God, does not meet the criteria even on that basis, regardless of the other issues that we've raised and talked about.
So one more thing I want to talk about here before we go is that we've tried to explain why God would allow for our command, actually, the conquest of Canaan. And I think that some people are still going to just say, well, look, I just don't like that. You know, you've given your answer, and I just don't like your answer. And I wonder if you could have any idea, anything else to say about why people might have that response.
Well, I would say, you know, if the answer that I've given is not satisfactory, and hey, there, I'm sure there's other answers out there that can add. Keep searching. I think part of the problem here, and I'm gonna mention two things. I think this partly has to do with the whole issue of the difference between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New. I think if you read the Bible carefully, you're going to find out that the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New are they're one and the same. And many people, you know, would feel, well, the God of Jesus that's in the New Testament could not have commanded the destruction of the Canaanites. In Revelation 19, we have Jesus coming back as the ultimate warrior,
right,
and destroying his enemies and carrying out judgment. And I think that's the larger issue that all of this raises is, for many people, the idea of a God who judges or a God who hates sin and holds us accountable for that sin,
right. That's
the problem.
Or to put it another way, the idea that we're not autonomous.
Right.
that we must bend the knee to God, to Jesus,
right,
is ultimately what's at stake here.
Right. Right. Yeah, every knee is going to bow and every tongue is going to confess. And there are consequences when we don't do that in this life and in this. And I think sometimes these become excuses to kind of turn away from really, really reflectively thinking about the consequences of, if there is that kind of God out there, what implications does that have for my life? And do I really, if I can explain away this God, then I don't have to think about my accountability to Him or my responsibility to believe in Jesus and to turn from my sin.
Yeah, I think one thing that might be helpful for, you know, skeptical people is to think about it this way. Instead of having an immediate reaction, oh, that's horrible that God would command us, think of it, suppose that God did exist, and they did create the world, and did have this intention for human beings. Given all that, would it be morally permissible for God to do the things that He commanded in the Old Testament, right?
Yeah, and I think this takes us back to a statement you made right at the very beginning of our discussion. The idea of God is working to get us back to Eden.
Right.
And so you can look at all the judgments that take place in history. The judgment of the flood is to purge the violence and evil that's in the world, and Noah becomes like a new Adam. Bringing Israel into the land is to create a place where God can dwell among His people so that they might be an influence among the nations. It's a form of new creation. And so ultimately the purpose of this judgment is never to destroy or simply to obliterate or simply for God to vent His anger. It ultimately is moving. There are various types of new creation leading us ultimately to the new creation that will happen in Revelation 21 and 22. Where violence, evil, injustice, violence, all the things that people hate and that they're using as moral objections against God, God is working in an imperfect world, and sometimes through imperfect forms of judgment, like using the Israelite army,
right,
to ultimately purge away the things that they're using as an objection not to believe in God in the first place. And I think, you know, if I could just encourage, take time to think and reflect on that. That's an important issue.
And I think there's at least one more point to make here, too. We keep saying that, but you know, you mentioned that we got to get our heads around the idea that Jesus is not just fluffy and nice all the time. That He has, He will judge the world, right? And but on the inverse side of that, too, when we read the Old Testament, and you read it with an open heart and open mind, well, you see that character of Jesus that we love so much, the compassionate, serving, loving person reflected in the character of God in the Old Testament.
Yeah, can I tie that into a passage from Isaiah? Isaiah 57, God identifies Himself and He says, I dwell in the high and holy place. And it says, thus says the one who is high and lifted up. It's the same expression that's used in Isaiah 6. I saw the Lord seated on His throne, high and lifted up. So God is this holy, awesome, powerful, terrifying God. But it also says, I dwell in the high and holy place, but also with Him who is of a contrite and lowly spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly, to revive the heart of the contrite. For I will not contend forever, nor will I always be angry. So here you've got this holy, righteous, exalted God, all the things that we think about of the Old Testament God, but also a God who says, I also dwell with those that are contrite and lowly. And so if that God, if He is ever going to step into the human race and demonstrate Himself, what would He look like? I think He's going to look just like the suffering servant Jesus.
Yeah, and I dwell with the contrite and lowly. That sounds a little bit like the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah, and I think the servant is described in Isaiah as being this kind of person who is contrite and lowly, and who is going to bear the sin of, And so what would this God look like if he stepped into human history? And I think the answer is he would look like Jesus Christ. Jesus didn't come to show us a God who is different from the Old Testament. He came to show us what the God of the Old Testament was truly like. And he shares the identity of the God of Israel. And I think this is a good passage to kind of make that, to bridge that connection.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us this week on the podcast of moralapologetics.com. Please check out our website when you get a chance. We're working on developing it into a resource for all your needs on the moral argument. Hope you enjoyed the conversation, and we'll see you next week.